Okay, I thought this was going to be insurance, but our groupies aren't here, so maybe they don't work after five. Maybe that's what it is here.
Some of them.
Okay, a couple of things. First, this is Matthias' first meeting. It's me presenting later on, so the rules apply. And secondly, really for the record, there was a press release came out saying that we'd agreed to put the dates to the end of the year. That was incorrect. We have not. And we'll do the best we can to hit the target if we can. Okay. Who's going in this one? Oh, sorry, Andrea. I was looking the wrong way.
We're such a big team. Okay. Over the next 24 hours, we plan to discuss the set of papers that... Not continuously, may I add.
Room, I don't.
You're saving that.
You obviously didn't do psychology.
We plan to discuss the set of papers that touch on many of the important topics in the insurance contracts project, either for decision or, because we're realistic, for education. In the cover note, Agenda Paper 3, we list the papers, a summary of the staff recommendations, and our project plan for the next couple of months. And I would stress that the project plan is obviously subject to change as things move in and out. By the end of this meeting, we hope to have a steer from the boards that will help us in developing the papers for next month. Today, we'll start with Agenda Papers 3A and 3D. And I'd like to start by turning to Paper 3A. Paper 3A describes some axioms and assumptions that, should the board agree, would underlie the development of future papers and insurance contracts. Paragraph 5 sets out axioms that we consider to be self-evident. As we state in paragraph 2, we see these as a starting point. It doesn't mean that the boards would necessarily take these axioms to their logical conclusion, but we thought it would be helpful to articulate explicitly something that's often left unsaid. In paragraph 6, we set out project assumptions. Unlike the axioms, these are assumptions about things that are a matter of decision by the boards. They reflect the decisions that the boards took in developing the ED and the DP. And for each of these items, we do not think that there was information in the comment letters that should result in the boards changing their views, except in specifically identified areas, such as we have in paragraph 6, D, E, and H. Together, these axioms and assumptions are intended to place some parameters around the model that the boards are developing for insurance contracts. So before I ask you the question at the end of paragraph 7, I'd like to ask for any comments or questions on Agenda Paper 3A.
Any questions? Okay, Warren, Jan, Tatsumi.
I like the paper and I agree with the axioms and assumptions. I think it hopefully will enable us to be more efficient in our re-deliberations and decision-making. And there's just one assumption that I think is missing, though, which I think is very important. It's an assumption that I think applies particularly, perhaps specifically, to the ISB, and that is that our decision-making, our re-deliberations of this topic, will be undertaken within the context of our existing literature, including IFRS 9. IFRS 9 has been issued some time now. It's been adopted a number of places around the world, and the board does not, at the present point in time, have any intention of changing IFRS 9. And so it needs to be, I believe, an assumption that we make in order to efficiently conduct our re-deliberations.
Okay, Tatsumi?
Oh, Jan, sorry.
I learned the other day that it's good to be stubborn, and the most unexpected things can happen, so I will just be stubborn and repeat that I think we have a too broad scope. I think we're making too many exceptions, and I think that a lot of the what we call insurance contracts could be treated as being much more of a normal service contract. So that's why I think that the assumption here is perhaps not the best. Though I don't expect to get much support for that yet.
Assuming?
Yeah. Thank you. I think at this time of the project, I think it's a very good thing to clarify these axioms and assumptions, so I don't know axioms. Anyway, so it's a very, very good for us to clarify that point. And also, you clearly articulated, say, accounting mismatch should be dealt with under this project, but economic mismatch should be clearly, articulated in the financial statement. So that message is very clear, and I support that message. But can I have some questions of your papers, such as on paragraph 4E little 1?
I think, Tatsumi, you might be looking at last month's paper.
Really?
So 6E, little one, because you've got this month's paper.
Oh, I'm still behind the times.
Nothing changes.
So, still, you mentioned about whether discount rate should be locked in or at cost, measure at cost. So that is a wish we should discuss. Means you are supporting or you're proposing this kind of things should be incorporated in our project?
Well, the intention, remember this paper was originally written for last month's meeting. In the papers for tomorrow, of course, there is a paper on locking in the discount rate. And it doesn't mean that at the time of writing this, it didn't mean that we necessarily supported or not, just that we would consider it again.
Oh, okay. So, same thing applies to H, because H also...
Exactly.
Okay, now I understand. Thank you.
Okay. Is that on the same points, Kamaro?
Yeah, same.
Okay.
I'd like just to start with praising the staff with the quality of the papers. And I think it's very important to acknowledge your effort and determination to have all these papers read for us. I have only one question on item 6B, the assumptions. Okay, I will read just to facilitate my question. The standard will deal with the accounting for insurance contracts from the perspective of the insurer. This is an open assumption that we might discuss financial guarantees, for instance, that are within the scope right now?
The general, the broad assumption is that it would deal with accounting for all insurance contracts. Now, there are a number of scope exclusions in the exposure draft EP, and I'd expect us to consider those scope exclusions again.
Okay. Yeah, maybe if I could just clarify, when we say insurer there, we mean it in the sense defined in the standards, which is the party that issues an insurance contract as we define it. It doesn't talk about the form of the institution that issues it.
So any entity that issues.
Might be clarified just for us to follow.
Okay, I've got Mark, Leslie, PK, Paul.
Mark. You can go on.
Sorry?
Wasn't it?
Okay. Leslie?
I just wanted to confirm my understanding based on discussion with the staff. I think there's a potential for confusion about the purpose of this paper. I don't understand that in any way it forecloses the possibility that we would develop a modified approach for certain types of contracts.
That's right. Yeah,
okay.
I agree with you.
Okay, thank you. The other point I wanted to make was just with respect to Warren's point about working under the assumption that IFRS 9 is going to be in place and you're not planning to open it up. Of course, that constraint does not apply to us in the U.S. We are currently working on our financial instrument standard, both of these are under development concurrently. So I'm sure that's obvious, but just wanted to state that for the record.
Okay.
I just wanted to speak from the heart on one issue, which is quite challenging for me personally. This is the point that Warren and Leslie just made. If some of you might recollect that I was very close to dissenting on IFRS 9, but that time has come and gone in my mind. If we make IFRS 9 in play, this is becomes a moving target, and it's almost impossible to make any kind of outreach activities in constituencies that I deal with. And if I make everything a fluid, it's almost impossible to convince, because India, for example, is considering to adopt or converge, whatever you want to say, financial instruments for the banks. And if I keep telling them this is at play, it is almost an impossible thing. So I think that's well captured in 6B, in my view, yeah. That not for the assets backing the contracts. And I think that's what I think the staff meant in IFRS 9. So I don't think we need an assumption separate, but I think it is inherent in this 6B. And I very firmly believe in that we got to keep IFRS 9 as it is. And I accept what Leslie said, that on the FASB side, it's in play, and that's fair.
Okay. Paul?
Actually, PK just said what I was going to say as well. I do support, though, Warren's suggestion that we add an explicit assumption. We are committed that when the FASB finishes their work on financial instruments, we will consider whether IFRS 9 should be reviewed. And I think all of us at IASB stand ready to do that and stick by our commitment there. But meanwhile, there are so many I'm new on this project. There's so many variables on insurance accounting. If we have got to say IFRS 9 is a given for now and proceed on all of the other issues on insurance, and when FASB finishes their work on financial instruments, we will consider whether to have another look at IFRS 9. But I would rather see it as an explicit assumption. PK's point is well taken. It's included in whatever it was, 6, on the assets backing the contracts. But I would feel more comfortable even if we said this is our assumption for now, at least IASB's assumption.
Okay, John?
And when we start talking about hedging, I'm going to remind the three of you that you're looking for a solution that keeps 9 the way it is.
Can I ring that bell?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you either are or not.
We've heard you 15 times.
Yeah, boring, don't worry. Boring.
Right.
Okay. Leslie? Sorry, not Leslie. Larry.
Hedging is not a standard yet.
We're not going to open.
Here's a nail.
All right. I was hoping that I could just get a little clarification on 6EII, which says that the inputs are consistent with the observable market data, and how that, how you consider that when an insurance company might have quite a bit of its own historical data that it might use to make estimates. Or if we decide to take a look at potentially other ways of coming up with discount rates or what have you. I'm just uncertain as to whether this is kind of locking me into certain decisions or what.
I think the intention of that is that the input should be consistent. It doesn't mean that they have to be the same. It doesn't mean that you have to use exactly what you observe, but it shouldn't contradict.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that I probably should have said it more clearly, it's focusing on financial market type data, so interest rates, equity prices and the like, doesn't give you any help really with inputs for mortality rates and things of that kind, so it's not getting at those kind of variables.
Which you don't have market data for so much anyway.
Or not much.
Honestly, yeah.
Which a clarification could always be when available, because it is the observable, as Peter said, the market data, where, when there's not an observable market for it. Obviously, it's not available, and therefore you would use your SD-specific.
Okay, Russ, do you want to come in?
Yeah, 2 points. One about what you just said about doesn't contradict this. When I first read 6B, I was worried that that would prevent us from considering a top-down approach for discount rates, since that is asset-backed. I don't think that's what you meant, though.
No.
Then the other thing is there's nothing in here about presentation or disclosure.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but I want to make sure that if I were to agree with C or F, that doesn't lock me into a net presentation.
No, and because it's so open, that's why there's no assumption about it.
Okay.
Sumi, you want to come in again?
One thing, Paul, I'm a little bit surprised at what Paul has indicated regarding the IFRS 9. Okay, but... okay. No. Okay. I stop saying.
What do you mean? That's it. Don't understand you.
I thought you'd agree with what he said.
No, it's irrelevant. I stop saying.
The inscrutable Japanese. Okay. Okay, that's it. Right. Any other comments on the paper? Okay. Can we move on? 3D, is it?
Question?
Sorry? Another question. What's the question? Does anyone disagree? This is just the basis of what we're doing. Is that okay? Okay. 3D.
Could I just ask for a clarification? Because I heard a number of people saying they thought we should add something probably along the lines of what Warren said, that it should be in the context of
ISB's
point of view, at least, our existing financial instruments literature.
ISB agrees.
Existing
literature.
Existing
literature. It has to be specified ISB.
Yep.
Yeah.
Anyone disagree on ISB?
Why is that so important?
Because if we don't, the presentation is going to get very difficult. The presentation is going to get very difficult for us.
I actually think you're talking about IFRS 9.
Yes. We'll see IFRS 9.
I don't disagree with that, but for me, paragraph 7 is important. It says, although we will revise the assumptions if necessary.
Oh, okay.
And because now I want to explain my view that we try to have a converged solution on insurance contracts. Now, if this leads the FASB to have a solution which is not only convergent but also where the question of mismatch is properly dealt with, and if we are blocked on that because of the conflict possible between IFRS 9 and the standard on insurance, are we really converged in the end? I'm not sure. We are partly converged. So I think we will have, in the end, to consider how you guys deal with that and see what is the impact of our process.
Sure. That could be a long time into the future, but that's the point.
John?
It seems to me by saying it, you're ignoring some things that we are doing that's inconsistent with 9. Embedded derivatives, potentially not breaking them out. How we look at cash flows, measurement on a portfolio basis, deposit floor. Right? There's just a lot of inconsistencies we have. So I don't know whether you need to say it. I think it's already in here. But
well, I think it's saying that this would not be, our deliberations would not be dependent upon changes to IFRS 9 that exists at the moment. It may be inconsistent in some areas. That was the point being made.
Okay. Is that all right, ISB? Okay. Thanks, Peter. Right, 3D.
Matthias.
Let us now move to agenda paper 3D. We will discuss the selection of the discount rate for non-participating contracts. That means these are the contracts where assets or asset portfolios do not influence the cash flows of these insurance contracts. Just as a reminder to yesterday's session on unbundling, where very often these cash flows are influenced by assets. So we are here only talking about the ones where assets do not influence the cash flows. We will not discuss the discount rate for in other cases. In this session, we will not discuss a split presentation between two different interest rates. We will also not discuss lock-in of discount rates, which we will do tomorrow, or specific situations of non-life contracts, which we will also do tomorrow. The discount rate where the amount, timing, and uncertainty of the cash flows depends on the performance of assets will be the topic in March. So let's now move to the discount rate for the non-participating contract. So why is that so complicated to find a discount rate? I think we should all bear in mind that we have a general idea
and the general objective to get to the time value of money. And we have cash inflows, cash outflows, but what really matters to us is what are these cash inflows and cash outflows worth in today's money? Therefore, reflect the time value of money. We do not care about what we do with these cash flows as soon as we have received them, because they are then outside of our model, just as a reminder for us. Based on the following analysis that you will hear, we will ask the board to confirm the objective of the discount rate to adjust the cash flows for the time values of money. We will also ask the boards not to prescribe one methodology going forward to determine the discount rate. And we will ask the boards to provide guidance. We will ask for that vote at the end of the session after we have discussed all the different methodologies to derive a discount rate. The structure of the discussion is as follows. We first wanted to provide a background to the boards about what has been done in the ED and what we have received and found out through our outreach and through the comment letter period on ED and discussion paper. Then in the main part, we will analyze the bottom-up approach, the so-called bottom-up approach, where you start with a risk-free interest rate and build an interest rate up. And another part that Shane will do, we will talk about the so-called top-down approaches, where you start with an asset rate, but then we will extract everything that does not relate to an asset. And then in the third part of that main part, we will talk about the possibility of prescribed rates. Then we will lead on to the staff recommendation on the topic. So, in the first section, I will hand over to Shane, who's done the background analysis for the boards.
Thank you, Matthias. Good evening. The ED proposes that the discount rate should be a risk-free rate plus a premium for liquidity. Many of the respondents to the ED and DP considered the selection of the discount rate as the most significant issue in the proposed measurement model. A minority of respondents to the DP and many of the respondents to the ED agreed with the proposal that the discount rate should be derived starting with a risk-free rate plus liquidity premium. However, in other instances, there was opposition to the proposal. That opposition tended to focus on the following points. The discount rate proposed will result in volatility to profit or loss that, in the view of some, does not represent the nature of the insurance industry. The proposal has a potential to create day one losses for long duration contracts. And finally, there is insufficient explanation in the proposal to determine a liquidity premium, and no standard methodology exists for calculating such a premium. As a result of these issues, respondents to both documents provided alternative solutions for determining the discount rate. The alternatives varied in complexity, but most suggested an asset-based rate, or what we have referred to as a top-down rate, in the staff analysis. I'd first like to ask the board if you have any questions on the comments that we've received before we head into actually explaining the risk-free rates and the asset-based rates, and then finally moving on to prescribed rates.
No questions? Okay, Shane.
Okay. With that, I'd like to turn it back over to Matthias, who will discuss the risk-free rates.
So, yeah, here's the tech team. To the bottom-up approach, and you can move to paragraph 23 in the paper where we start the discussion on the bottom-up approach. We start with a risk-free rate, and the discussion there is focused on how the risk-free rate is determined, what is a risk-free rate, what happens for very long durations, and what other characteristics should we consider when we determine a discount rate to discuss the cash flows, depending on the nature of the cash flows and the characteristics of the liability. Coming to what is a risk-free rate? It sounds very easy in the beginning, and it gets more complicated when you think about it more. It is a theoretical rate of return for an investment that has no risk. And components of that is a real return and a compensation for the inflation that I'm expecting. Proxies very often, or has been in the past, governmental bonds. We're using that proxy, and in the short term, that proxy is fairly good. We've discovered problems with that proxies in countries where the government just decides to print money, and the expectations on how this money will be printed in the future is not reflected in the pricing for governmental bonds. We've also discovered issues in situations like in the Eurozone in the last year. And some have suggested that another proxy for countries or environments like the Eurozone could be the swap rate that banks are using to find a discount rate. Another problem that you're facing in finding a yield curve for longer durations is the very long durations, where you're expanding a yield curve beyond times that you have observable market data. First of all, we really do not know how deep the markets are on some of these instruments. If, for example, if you look at UK gilt that has just that dip in the yield curve at the end, because it's a very dried out market, and typically insurance companies would be the sole investors in these instruments, driving down the prices. Another question is, should we extrapolate, interpolate? How should we expand the yield curve going forward? There are various different techniques how you expand the yield curve. Given the theory that in the long run, over market cycles, people would expect a stable return except for the effects of inflation on a risk-free asset. We should all bear in mind that we are really trying to approximate a risk-free rate and not the rate of a governmental bond. So we are not trying to approximate the proxy, but we are trying to get to the risk-free rate. So having gone through that, we might find a discount rate that is risk-free. In the next step, we should think, what other characteristics do our cash flows have in order that we need to discount? And that first characteristic that comes to mind is own credit. During the discussions about the exposure draft and the discussion paper, it was decided that own credit should not be included, while we think that it is a characteristic of a liability, but it should not be included. We should also bear in mind when we talk about own credit that we are not talking about the borrowing rate of the insurer, but the own credit to the policyholder, who usually ranks first in line in front of the other debtors. So that characteristics we had exposed in the exposure draft, and the overwhelming majority had said that we should not include that characteristic based on the counterintuitive impact that you see from movements in own credit. Another very important characteristic of these cash flows is illiquidity. We are adjusting the cash flows for the fact that the policyholder would surrender, making these cash flows highly illiquid. Discounting these cash flows with a governmental bond rate or a risk-free rate alone would not be a sufficient discount rate and would be a too low discount rate. Therefore, it would be helpful to include the characteristic liquidity or illiquidity in these in the discount rate. Having that said, it is very complicated and has not been yet fully understood how illiquidity adjustment should be performed. And a majority of the comment letters have told us it is too complicated to determine the illiquidity adjustment to the discount rate. Coming to the conclusion on the risk-free rate, the discount rate for our cash flows should have the characteristics, a real risk-free return adjusted for inflation, so a risk-free return, and should consider the liquidity characteristic. And then we figured it is hard to determine both risk-free rate and illiquidity. And therefore, we thought about considering other alternatives like a top-down approach excluding effects from an asset-based trade. But I'm pausing here to ask for questions on the risk-free rate and how the so-called bottom-up approach would be.
Okay.
First of all, although I know that raises the bar, I would really say staff have prepared great papers for today, and I like this paper very much because it spells out all the issues. Matthias, one question. I think you've rightly pointed out the difficulties about defining what's risk-free. You've rightly pointed out that as of today, there is no common understanding on how to come to illiquidity measures. On the other hand, when looking a bit across the line, looking at the Solvency II ideas and all that, could you expand a bit on the idea to work with the what could be alternatives if you want to stay bottom up to come up with what you are characterizing as a measurement here? Again, going to swap rate, acknowledging that we have credit risk in there and volatility, but it's at least a very long curve I can look at, and considering how to potentially, well, come to something that I could take as a proxy for illiquidity. I'm not surrendering on this one first.
So I guess... And again, some have suggested the swap rates as being a suitable candidate to expand the yield curve. However, that has some credit risk in there.
Yeah.
As it's pointed out in the paper also, these are usually collateralized swaps, but it is getting us closer. I think to get to a risk-free rate, the swap rate would be a proxy, a suitable candidate, especially in Europe. But again, there's some risk in there. It's all a proxy. We are really trying to approximate something.
What about illiquidity?
On the illiquidity, I have to admit that it's very hard to get your arms around it. But I think that we should not limit the assessment of what illiquidity means just to compare two bonds to each other. I think a bond that is traded and a bond that is not traded, a very large part of illiquidity lies in the fact that if I know I have to pay out in 50 years or in 30 years a cash flow, and that is a fully illiquid cash flow, there is some value in the fact that you can hold the bonds through market cycles. Now, that is something that, in my mind's eye, should be considered in determining that liquidity adjustment, which I think is not exactly the way that it's currently done in Solvency II. That helping you?
Any other comments? Oh, sorry.
I agree completely with your analysis, but I also want to make the observation that the challenges you find going from a bottom-up approach may be equally or greater going top-down. If we end up reversing out the risks that should not be in the top-down rate to get to the correct discount rate to reflect the risks inherent that are not reflected in the cash flows. I just want to make that observation.
Okay.
Hopefully you meet in the middle at the right place.
All right.
So.
I have 2 points. The first one relates to your original TIA, and you said basically the objective of the measurement is to reflect the time value of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my only point there is that that's an objective that is extremely wide, because when we talk about present values, present value is probably mostly discussed in connection with Con 7, and done so in light of how to calculate a fair value. If we're not using that as our measurement objective, to say we're trying to reflect the time value of money, I don't know where
in the range that time value of money is, because present value is nothing but a calculation. It's a calculation where you take a bunch of cash, estimated cash flows, and you apply a discount rate, whatever that might be. So I don't think the objective guides us very well. Okay, that's the first point. The second point is, and this might be very fundamental, and maybe I have it backwards, but when we talk about the bottoms-up approach, we always start with the risk-free rate, and what we're trying to do is we're trying to come up with a rate that's characteristic of the liability. Okay. We ignore the first characteristic of the liability. We've all agreed we're going to throw credit risk of the insurer out the window. We're not going to consider that. But yet we all acknowledge that that's a fundamental characteristic of the liability. And then we talk about illiquidity. And all of the discussions in the papers about illiquidity revolve around the policyholder. Okay? And it's not... If you go through the analysis, you'll see quite a bit of discussion revolving around the policyholder. And it's really not the policyholder that we're concerned about. We're concerned about the insurer and whether the estimate of the timing of the cash flows corresponds with the actual payment that will occur and the timing of that payment.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm just having a difficult time understanding. If I believe that the payment is going to occur in year 30, but my risk is that I don't pay it out in year 30, but I'm called to pay it out in year 15, why are we adding to the risk-free rate? It seems to me that you wouldn't be adding.
And this is the point why we are talking about the policyholder here, because in a first step in the cash flows, we are looking at all the situations where the policyholder surrenders and lapses, and there we have to look at the policyholder, because that's our counterparty, which determines where we get our cash flows from, or we give our cash flows to. So all that liquidity part, all that risk that I have an early payout at one point, is in the cash flows. And that consequently leads me to the point that the cash flows are certain equivalents at one point, and there's no liquidity risk that I need to reflect somewhere. However, a liquid instrument that I'm using a discount rate from has that risk embedded, governmental bond rate, for example. We have that included. The chance to liquidate that instrument is reducing the interest rate there. And that is not a characteristic of the cash flows anymore. We have reduced the cash flows, and in order to put the appropriate combined measure to that, we would need to increase the discount rate. The problem that we just have is we don't exactly know how much.
Could I maybe add to that as well, because I think you can see it from the policyholder side and the insurer side as well. And if we strip out all the complicating factors like uncertainty and cash flows, and let's just assume we've got a single fixed cash flow 30 years out or something, and think about what kind of rate the policyholder would require and what sort of rate the insurer would be willing to pay, because obviously the rate you observe will be the result of some sort of negotiation or market clearing process between them. And I think that the policyholder is likely to require a higher rate if the money is going to be tied up versus if they have some flexibility either to put it back to the insurer directly or to sell it on the market in some way. So I think those factors explain why you'd expect the policyholder, everything else being equal, to expect a slightly higher return. And similarly, if the insurer has got the flexibility to use the proceeds and know that they won't be called on to pay out unexpectedly, then they'll be willing to pay a slightly higher amount for that flexibility as well. So I think that explains why you'd expect some addition to the rate. It doesn't give you much help, of course, trying to estimate what the amount is, but I think intuitively it makes some sense.
Okay, so what you're doing, though, is you're answering my first question in terms of how are we going to anchor the time value of money, and you're doing so in terms of what the market would bear.
Yeah, and I think it's I find
and,
it quite.
And if we're willing to accept that, fine. But I think to evaluate this particular subject, we need to understand that.
Yeah, and I think it's difficult not to do it probably in a market context. And I think you could try and come up with some sort of entity-specific view of the design.
That's fine.
But I think
you're saying be explicit, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, I
bet the
aren't, all I'm trying to understand is what we're trying to do.
Yeah. No, that's a fair question.
Yeah. Okay.
Steve, you wanted to come in?
I just wanted to try and answer Larry's second question because I think the answer is the risk adjustment. You were saying that why would you not have a deduction from the rate to allow for the fact why would you not have a deduction for the rate because the cash flows could be paid at different times? Well, you don't want that if you've got a risk adjustment as well.
Oh, that, and I was also implying that we're
duplicating, yes. Which we wouldn't be if we don't have that deduction. So as long as we have the rate that Peter was talking about, then we're fine. But if I can just, while I've got the mic, seems to me that the answer is conceptually very simple because effectively you're borrowing money from policyholders. They're paying you in advance. And therefore, the rate should be what you would pay for borrowings of similar characteristics. The variability of the date of payment and the amount, that's dealt with in estimating the cash flows and the risk adjustment, so you're left with effectively just straight financing, and you need to have whatever rate would normally be paid for that financing. Of course, that would include an own credit amount, but we heard yesterday that is very small, so I'm willing to ignore that on the basis that it is so small. I think conceptually it should be there. I don't actually agree with the sole reason we exclude it is the counterintuitive effects, because there are ways of dealing with those other than just ignoring it. But the reason I'm willing to ignore it is because it's such a small amount. But so I think conceptually the answer is clear. It's a borrowing rate. How much would that insurance company pay for borrowings of that seniority, that maturity in the market? And it's not a bond, obviously, because it's you're borrowing in a form that isn't tradable, so it's akin to a bank loan. But what I've said, I don't think, is inconsistent with what the staff has in the paper.
Tom, you want to come in?
I thought Larry brought up two really important points, and I think we ought to think about whether or not we needed to define the objective as being more than the time value of money. Not that it isn't the time value of money. But in some respects, I think a very real objective is that what we put in the cash flows in terms of uncertainty, or if there's any risk in it, but I don't think there is uncertainty in it, we don't want to double count that in the discount rate. But if there are risks there that are not accounted for in the cash flows, we want to reflect those risks in the present value calculation that's inherent in the contract. And so we want a time value of money discount rate that doesn't double count things but reflects the risks that aren't in the cash flows. And I think that's a very good objective, and we've got that in other places in our literature. The real challenge about this, though, is we don't know what's in the cash flows in terms of liquidity. Even in this paper, you suggest maybe the amount of money that you accept on the inflows on an insurance contract reflects the fact that the insurer doesn't have risk that they have to pay out for a long time period, that there is this illiquidity problem for the insured. And if the amount's in the cash flows already, do we want to adjust for it in the rate? And that is a challenge as we go through. If we were to set the objective that way, do we ever really know exactly all the risks that were factored in into the pricing? Because if the pricing changes, like you suggest in illiquidity, that it could be that you don't charge as much because you don't have that risk. I don't think you want to double count it in the discount rate, and I don't think we can be omniscient enough to know what everything went into the price, in part because it's market demand, what the market will bear. So it's going to make it challenging for any set of adjustments that we think of bottom up or top down, because we're not going to be omniscient about everything that's in the cash flows.
This is sort of a minor point about the risk-free analysis that you were talking about, but I may have misheard you, so forgive me.
Yeah.
I thought you were saying you would want to consider the seniority of the instrument, and that seems to be related to the credit risk of the insurer.
For the to the credit risk of the insurer to the policyholder versus the borrowing rate. If you look at the insurance company that borrows in the market, that would be a different rate than the spread. The credit spread would be a different spread than the one to the policyholder, because the policyholder is senior to every other. In most countries, is senior to every other borrower. So if you have a regular bond out there as an insurance company, the policyholders will get their money first. So they are senior to anybody else.
So it suggests that if you have a AAA corporate issuing a senior note, that you would be issuing it below a risk-free rate.
If that is a stable insurance company.
Okay, thanks.
Recently, both boards have been reviewing the pre-ballot draft on fair value measurement, and in that document, we talk about how to determine the discount rate involved with a level 3 measurement of financial liabilities as well as financial assets. And the language in there essentially gives us either a top-down or bottom-up approach. And you allude to that methodology by reference to the ISB expert advisory panel, but more specifically now it's been incorporated into this document that both boards are going to presumably approve here very shortly. So I appreciate what Tom just said, that, you know, if you're trying to capture uncertainty about risk and cash flows, you wouldn't try to double count it in the interest rate, but you can never be sure you've captured all the risk in the cash flows. And so what I guess one of the comments that I offered on that document is I don't think that we should foreclose the estimate of any kind of risk in the interest rate if we've tried to capture it in the cash flows. In other words, it doesn't militate automatically for using the risk-free rate and only the risk-free rate because of the point that you just made. You can't be absolutely omniscient that you've captured all uncertainty. So that's point number one. Point number two is with respect to paragraph 39, and that is it doesn't seem like we've heard much from the industry in the context of a bottom-up approach where you're using a risk-free rate plus illiquidity premium, adjusting for this volatility that they think may not be adequately captured through an adjustment of the risk margin or risk adjustment. Now, that obviously also presupposes that you are somebody who favors the measurement of the liability using an explicit risk adjustment or risk margin, not a composite margin approach. Is that an accurate or fair statement?
I think I would put one point to it. If we think about risks and uncertainties and maybe adjusting the interest rate for risk, we should bear in mind that we are trying to capture cash flows and present value these cash flows. And if we use a risk adjustment in a discount rate, for example, we are assuming that the relief from risk is following the same pattern that you have with your cash flows. That may, from my mind's eye, not always be true for insurance contracts, because for example, you get an annuity payment after you have an accident. After that, the main risk is gone that you have to that contract. So risks jumping up and down. But if you say, oh, you include that in your discount rate, for example, then you are assuming that the relief from risk is exactly following how your cash flows are going out the door.
So I guess just to,
Tommy, answer.
More precisely to say, is it possible to capture some of the uncertainty in the realization of asset cash flows through the risk adjustment? In other words, your ability to fulfill your obligation to the policyholder is a function, obviously, of realizing certain cash flows, right, from the portfolio.
Yeah.
And my question is whether or not you can capture in the risk adjustment the risk and uncertainty associated with realizing cash flows from the portfolio.
But why would that affect the measurement of the liability?
Unless it's a
because it affects your ability to fulfill the obligation. If you have no investment income, if you have no maturities, if everything defaulted and you had no portfolio.
So like ruin risk.
You're talking about a replicating portfolio situation.
Well, I don't know. But my question is whether or not it's possible to capture any of that risk it is, but I guess this is my question for Matthias.
So you doing that in the discount rate, I have not seen a methodology that could do that to go to ruin. You're talking in essence about a ruin of the insurance company, so that he goes bankrupt and is not able to fulfill his payment. I'm not sure if that can be done in a discount rate. But.
I think there's about, you've got two hands up. Tom's got two hands up. Okay, so I'll go in the order. That was Steve, Mark, and then Tom.
Perhaps the I think what you're talking about would actually be the opposite way around. Remember the Deloitte presentation and the risks that go different directions? The sort of thing you're talking about has the opposite effect, and it's consistent with the own credit. That's exactly what you're describing is exactly the own credit situation.
Mark?
I thought it was a non-performance risk too, but are you, is another way to talk about it, like are you thinking about, the other way to handle it I guess would be to include in the cash flows expected returns on the assets, which I don't know if that's what you're saying.
No.
Okay, but then why would you? It's either non-performance risk or it's.
Your non-performance essentially results by not realizing cash flows.
So it's non-performance risk, or you want to include the cash
and
flows.
So it's an indirect way of essentially looking at non-performance risk.
So it reduces, I think it's the liability. Non-performance risk.
No, it would be increasing.
I think so.
Increasing.
Yeah. I
think that what you might be talking about is, at least if I'm understanding you correctly, I think you could probably do that in the discount rate if you started with a top-down approach and you factored within the discount rate, starting with an asset-based rate and factored in defaults of not getting those cash inflows. I guess I haven't thought it through a lot, but I guess that would capture the default of
right.
You not receiving the cash flows.
But I guess my point is this, Shane.
But
because you are saying in this paper that is an appropriate or reasonable methodology of approximating the rate that's appropriate to discount the liabilities, you raise in paragraph 39 that there are potentially other ways in the total measurement of liability to capture uncertainty, one of which is the risk margin. And so what I was asking is whether or not the risk margin is also another place where you could capture the risk that you just described, as opposed to in the discount rate.
I wanted to react to something that Peter said, and I think it's very important, and it ties to what paragraph 75 says. But what Peter said is that we're discounting the liability, and that gets us thinking about all flows. But for me, what we have is a net inflow-outflow calculation within this insurance contract model. And we have to think about both net inflows and outflows, the risks that the insurer has in the net inflows and outflows, and the risk the insurer takes on to apply paragraph 75. And there's two risks the insured takes on, liquidity risk and credit risk. And we add the liquidity risk because if the insurer doesn't have it, the liability's not as high. You want to add it so the liability's lower. That's paragraph 75. But the insurer keeps two risks, I think. One is a risk that the amount that you pay out will be different than you put into the expectation of uncertainty. That's a risk margin. And this would say deduct the discount so the liability's higher, but we may be doing that directly rather than the discount rate by measuring it. But the other risk that the insurer has is that the returns that they get in their expected rate, we're not going to put the expected returns in the cash flow, but the returns that they're investing in could be different from what's expected. And it would seem to me that either has to be adjusted for if it's not in the risk margin, or we've got to begin to rethink about what we're doing with the risk margin, that it ought to be the cash flows or the net inflows and outflows and the risk related to the net cash flows. But we don't have a liability here, just an outflow. We've got a net contract. And I think we have to think about that in the discount rate and the risk margin.
Can I respond to that in a couple of things? And there's one thing I wasn't quite sure where you were coming from, Tom. When you're talking about inflows and outflows, were you talking about the investments as well, or were you just talking about the inflows and outflows on the contract itself?
I'm talking about the inflows and outflows on this contract, but inherent in the inflow calculation is an expected return that we're building into this. And if we start with an asset rate, there's going to be expected return. There's a return that's built in the accretion process in our net liability on the income side that has an expected return. I don't think that's going to be accounted for, as Matthias said, outside the model within interest income. But there is a risk that the insurer has about that the returns will be different from expected. And that is a risk that potentially we have to consider adjusting for. Some of us have been influenced by the American Academy of Actuaries paper. That's exactly one of the risks that they put in and adjust for.
But Tom, this is in the fair value of the asset.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there are
we don't need to double count.
I think there are two different aspects probably to what Tom's talking about. One is what happens with the investment risk, and I think it's worth thinking of two different components of that. One is the pure asset risk itself, the risk that the assets and that the assets may not deliver as much cash as you expected, and that you'd expect to be picked up in the asset valuation, just that pure sort of standalone asset risk. There's obviously also an asset liability mismatch risk, that if you're very well matched, right, they should move together. If you're mismatched, then they won't move together, and you're more exposed on the net. But I wouldn't see the mismatch risk, per se, as being something that you'll pick up in the liability measurement. It doesn't relate specifically to the liability. The place you deal with it is in capital requirements or deciding how much equity you need and so on. The American Academy of Actuaries paper was really, I think, talking in a way about adjusting for mismatch risk if you're starting. It's a kind of top-down approach, really.
Correct.
And you're starting with a top-down portfolio that's not exactly matched.
Correct.
And then obviously you need to adjust for that to get to something that's close to the characteristics of the liability. The other thing that I thought you were maybe concerned about is we're looking at a set of inflows and outflows to and from the policyholder, and some other people as well, but basically the policyholder in effect. And sometimes people think that we maybe need to think separately about those, because obviously on inflows you normally have credit risk is one of the main things you normally think about. If you think about something like a 20-year term policy, policyholder paying monthly premiums, you pay a death benefit if the policyholder dies, then the main risk you've got on the inflows isn't really credit risk, because if the policyholder dies, the premiums stop. If the policyholder lapses, the death benefit stops. So credit risk isn't such a big issue there, and where we deal with the uncertainty is on an aggregate basis, looking at the risk adjustment on the portfolio level. And once you've taken out all those risks, then you can go to using just looking at the pure time value of money.
And I agree with all that. I actually agree with Stephen that that asset risk is going to be over on the asset side. However, and so on a bottom-up approach, it's not in the calculation.
But the key thing that we have to recognize that in the top-down approach, it is in the expected return on the asset side, and it's something that we've got to worry about not leaving in the asset rate when we come top-down, because that adjustment should be over on the asset side, not the liability. So I didn't want it to be on the liability issue, but it is a key area. That's why I believe when we start thinking about top-down, the number of just adjustments that we're going to have are far more than what we do building bottom-up.
Well, you were jumping ahead, aren't you?
Right.
I'm answering to you.
I don't think Shane or Matthias may have understood my question, but if you look at paragraph 45, and you look at the bar graph there, I guess this paper has been written from the perspective that you can determine the rate from either a top-down or bottom-up approach. And I fully endorse that and understand that. All I'm saying is, to the extent, if you use the bottom-up approach, you don't get to what you think is an appropriate rate to discount the liability. Can some of that uncertainty related to the time value of money be captured in the risk margin or no?
Can I try and answer that indirectly? Because I think it's something that... I think quite interesting in the Canadian approach, which we had in the presentation last month. And if you remember, the way they go about it, they start with the contractual cash flows, they take out the expected defaults, and then they take out an adjustment which, for shorthand, everybody calls unexpected defaults. And the way they do it is they look at experience over a long time. I think the way they do it, they go back to sort of pre-Great Depression, and then they set it at a fairly high level. And that is a mechanism they incorporate in the discount rate to get back to something that's sort of close-ish. We can debate that to the something that's just the characteristics of the liability. And when we were talking about that to them, I was trying to rationalize what they were doing to the way we built up the building blocks in the ED. And the way I described it to them was that, in a way, what you're doing is the deduction you're making for expected defaults is... Conceptually, in a way, it's quite similar to a confidence level approach, that you're looking at the risk that the asset return is less than you expected, and you're going for a high confidence level. I mean, they haven't explicitly specified what it is, but I think it's conceptually like that. Of course, what that doesn't do is it doesn't take out the market spread for the credit risk. It sort of substitutes it with their own confidence level replacement.
You're right, it doesn't answer my question.
Well, it doesn't exactly, but in a way what they're doing is they're taking a sort of risk adjustment type approach similar to one of our techniques
and
sort of building it into the discount.
But I'm talking about from bottom up.
Yeah, so Pat, on the bottom up, I mean, if you're doing bottom up, we haven't included, as other people have said, we haven't included the expected investment returns yet anywhere in the calculation. And so now we're saying... If we're starting from a bottom up, we're again not including anything that has to do anything with my investment return. Starting from a top down approach, I am including my expected yield. So now what you're doing would be adding in addition a detriment, I guess I would say, to the insurance company when I've never added the benefit or the expected inflows from the investment yield anywhere else in the calculation. So then you're saying, can I adjust for potentially not getting what I thought I'd get? But what I thought I'd get is nowhere in here yet. If we start with an expected return or an asset base, whatever, you know, whichever one and what's in the paper, one of those methods, now you have included implicitly that potential investment return in the calculation. Now I'm looking at going, well, now I have the risk of not achieving that, so now I have to take that risk out of here. So
fair
if you're
enough.
Doing the top, the bottom up, you never have it to adjust for the rest. Only top down.
That's a very sound explanation. But for example, what if you don't believe you've captured all the illiquidity risk?
Right. Could you also be part of the risk adjustment?
Okay. All right. So
the illiquidity will be part of the risk adjustment.
Okay. Elke.
I think your first question before we got into this discussion was answered by Peter, and I agree. The unexpected default, the unexpected mismatch between the assets and the liabilities is something you have to cover in equity. It's not part of your liability calculation to say, well, I might not be able to make sufficient returns to come up with, to make up for my liability. I'm covering that risk on the asset side, and for the unexpected, it's capital requirements. And I think Peter said that, and I would agree.
Okay.
Otherwise, you wouldn't need capital for an insurance company.
Okay. So since we seem to want to talk about the top-down, jump into the top-down. When we discuss asset-based rates, it is important to keep in mind that the staff did not intend to change the objective of discounting as described in the ED, but rather provide an alternative for achieving the same result in what some have suggested may be an easier manner. The staff are not prescribing, nor are we endorsing, any particular asset-based methodology for achieving that objective. The staff would also like to remind the boards of the education sessions held in January 17th and February 3rd of this year, with a discussion focused on the top-down methods for calculating the discount rate. With this in mind, the staff began our analysis with the basic premise that it should not matter whether the construct starts from a top-down or a bottom-up approach. The result should be the same if all asset risks are subtracted or excluded from the calculation. The table on page 17 of Agenda Paper 3D provides one depiction of what risks should be considered. The table is not meant to represent a comprehensive list or the only way to think about these risks. The staff are confident others may have a different idea of what risks exist. We also realize that some may suggest that a top-down approach is just as subjective and possibly as hard to calculate as a bottom-up approach. Notwithstanding those arguments, though, the staff believe that the calculation could be done. So first, I'd like to just point out some highlights from the portfolio rate, just to take you through pieces of the paper. And the portfolio rate analysis begins, paragraph 50 for your reference. There are practical differences between the actual asset portfolio and the reference portfolio. One being that obviously the actual assets are what the entity is currently invested in or may invest in the future, while a reference portfolio is an ideal asset portfolio to try to closely match cash outflows. The actual asset portfolio could be invalidated if the strategy of the entity is not to match asset and liability cash flows. We do acknowledge that, but our analysis assumes that that is the entity strategy. Therefore, the differences between reference and actual assets are not that much. We also want to point out that the reference portfolio that we describe in the paper is not a replicating portfolio. A replicating portfolio would suggest that the cash flows exactly match. This ideal reference portfolio would come as close as possible to matching the cash flows. Portfolio method, we also would like to say that portfolio methods have the same issue as risk-free rates in that the yield curves would need to be extrapolated out to long-term yields. The expected return is a current rate based on the observable inputs of that asset portfolio. The expected return as described here does not include long-term performance or expectations by the entity. It's the current observable input. If these amounts were included in an expected return, they would have to be backed out just as they would if you had the portfolio. So the conclusion for the portfolio rate is that the staff believes that the calculation could be done using a portfolio rate with either a reference or an actual asset. Many have suggested through the comment letters that a rate based on the pricing of products is similar to a portfolio rate methodology, and therefore should be considered as part of a top-down approach. So the staff looked at pricing rate methodologies also as part of a top-down approach. A couple of highlights that we would like to put forward. The pricing rates contemplate long-term expectations of a portfolio of assets based on the investment strategy of the entity. This expectation of return on those assets is used to model various scenarios to determine an appropriate price that you would charge for a premium. The methodology suggests that the assets and liabilities are linked in that the assets invested in and the return on those assets are used to fund the ultimate liability. Some have argued that if the rate does not consider this linkage between the liability and the assets invested in to fund the liability, the accounting would not reflect how insurers manage their business. The staff has concluded through our analysis that we're not convinced that a pricing rate would work to obtain a rate that would reflect the characteristics of the liability for a couple of reasons. We're not sure how the pricing on day two would correlate with rates for the liabilities. We're not convinced of this inherent linkage between the asset and the liabilities. And we are also concerned that we would have to think about some sort of a test for any expected return that came up, to make sure that expected return was realistic. And also, when you start backing out amounts from an expected return in the pricing rate, because we're using long-term expectations, we're not really at a point in time, a current market rate. We're factoring in long-term performance. So I'm not sure that you could get to the right rate. With that said, I'll open the floor up for questions.
Potentially to add to your concerns about pricing rate, I would be very concerned that you get some very difficult, anti-abuse issues or whatever you call them around it, because you might find an insurer not being considering to reconsider pricing because of the impact that might have to the existing portfolio and things like that. And I think it was discussed with different constituents, especially, for example, with EFRAG, and most agreed, at least those I've talked to, that a pricing rate is a very sloppy road to go.
Mark?
Just a question, Shane, on the pricing analysis that you just did. And one of the things you mentioned as a argument against it was that on day two, maybe it doesn't reflect a current measure of that particular liability. And I guess I can understand on a contract-by-contract basis, but aren't we contemplating doing this at a portfolio level?
We are contemplating doing it on a portfolio level, but I think the question becomes, are we using the current pricing as of today with liabilities that we've already previously recorded that contemplated previous pricing, and how does that correlate? Or are we using some sort of a blended pricing rate, or are we using historical pricing rates? So I'm not quite sure how that would correlate. And because it also takes – that return takes into consideration – the investment returns and performance expectations that move out into the future, I think it's our opinion that it would be relatively difficult to make that correlation and back out the proper amounts that would need to be backed out to get to a rate that would reflect the characteristics of the liability.
Maybe to add to that, I think if your pricing is based on current market expectations, and you're deducting current market expectations, and you keep that current every single time you value your liabilities, your pricing would work, but I don't think that anybody does this pricing this way. But we not say it wouldn't work, but it could, but that would be fairly close to a portfolio rate or an asset, the asset rate, where you take current market information, not just the hope the insurer has to earn. I think that is.
I think there's so many complications in this, whether you go bottom up, whether you go top down. I mean, I don't disagree with the way Stephen characterized it. When you at the end of the day, it's a net borrowing if you will, of an uncertain duration, but you're making an estimate of the duration. In leases, what we did is we said we're going to measure that by either the incremental borrowing rate or the rate that's inherent in the contract. And, you know, so it was just one. Yeah, it's just I wonder if it's a practical expedient by looking at current measures of how you're pricing it, whether it's easier to do it that way versus going through a whole reference portfolio or not.
I think it would probably be as difficult to do as a portfolio. So I'm not sure that you would – what you would give up in accuracy and completing the – and attaining the objective of what we're trying to do, I don't think you would gain as a practical expedient, if that makes sense. So we're not getting – so
– You think it would be
– I think it would be just as hard. It would be just as hard and the measure would be worse. Potentially.
That's the antithesis of a practical expedient, actually.
Said well.
Just to add, I guess to add on to a couple of things on the pricing, that the difficulty. One is if you use the subsequent, what's included in the pricing, subsequently you're ignoring the fact that you actually received some cash in already and invested that. So that's one of the concerns on that. I think the bigger concern is that pricing is not well defined. So while theoretically it's my expected return, it's my implicit return in the product, it makes sense, I think that when you come down to it, pricing is not well defined when an actuary goes ahead. If you go to a pricing actuary and say, what's your investment return, while they might have intended for it to be 5% and they get pushed on what the market will bear, it moves potentially and say, well, it's within a range and I might now put it at 5.3. And then, so it's a little squishy. There's not a lot around it. I think to Alki's point also, when I get down to a price, one of the concerns could be if I change my mortality assumption and change my price and my investment return, there is some room for abuse, still getting down to the same premium. So there would be some concerns around the control. Not that I'm saying that would happen, but I think some even in the industry would say that it's theoretically a right price, but there's some issues with it.
My view is that it's a portfolio, and there's going to be some premiums that you receive. There's also going to be new contracts that are going to be issued, and your point about what the market is bearing just seems to me to be something that is a little bit more observable and that is more of a current rate. So, I don't know. There's points and counterpoints, I think, to each of these.
Okay, we've got 20 minutes left. A lot of flashing lights here. Steve?
I don't think the pricing rate works. I think it's not like a lease because you've got a series of prescribed cash flows in that case, and I think insurance is very different. I've got two questions. Firstly, are any of the three methods that we heard about last month consistent with this paper and your objective? So do any of those three work? And secondly, in paragraph 45, am I to take it that the rate that you're after is the liquid risk-free plus the first three boxes? I don't want to sort of get into expense risk and the unexplained residual. Essentially, we're going beyond the illiquidity risk. So therefore, from an asset perspective, the key things we're deducting are expected default losses and then the reward for default risk. So my concern is that those two amounts are just as difficult to estimate as the illiquidity premium. And people told us they cannot measure illiquidity. Well, of course, one way of measuring illiquidity would have been to have derived it as the balancing number by doing the top-down. So the fact that people said they can't do illiquidity seems to me that they're telling us they can't do either bottom-up or top-down.
I think that that's a fair statement. I think that what we have proved in this paper is that we've came to the conclusion that none of the approaches are superior to the other, and it's a fair statement that those elements that you've just mentioned are hard to calculate.
Because the,
just as hard as liquidity.
Okay, because the Deloitte, they took out the expected default losses, because that is something where there's a bit more data on and historical data, but they didn't attempt to go any further, and they said it was just too difficult. So they're not getting to the rate that...
That's right.
Okay, so that answers that question, because their rate wasn't consistent with...
That's right.
With this. Now, what about the other two approaches where they were doing some sort of risk adjustment? Was their approach consistent with what you're recommending?
I think that it was, I wouldn't say that it was consistent with the approach in that they captured every single risk that needed to be backed out. So, yes, they were able to do it, but I'm not sure that having thought about this, if they had captured all those risks. I think we would have to go back and examine that work again.
I don't think you need to. I don't think they were consistent.
Shane, was that because that wasn't part of the objective, or that it wasn't possible to capture them?
I think it was a little bit of both. I think the objective was for them to show us their method that they presented, which they did. The other part of that, the time frame that we gave them to do this exercise was very limited. So there was a lot of difficulty in just being able to accomplish their method in the time frame that we gave them. So it's a little bit of both.
Yeah, I would add to that. I think that the objective that these two methods have, like leaving Deloitte aside, we just said the Deloitte approach has explicitly stated that they only deduct one risk. The other approaches at least had the target and the objective to achieve that. But again, we are not endorsing or trying to say one way or the other, and we are not saying this achieves it. But they had that objective in mind when they were trying to get through their approach to deduct as much that is not related to the characteristic of liability from these asset rates that they have.
True, but the rates they ended up with varied by portfolio composition.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So that indicates to me that
that's correct.
By definition it's not what we're asking for in this paper.
And to be fair, I think that we would have to go back, look at that work, and then compare to say, what else could they have pulled out?
Sure, I mean... Well, they haven't removed the whole of the expected default losses and the reward for default risk.
No, but they have partially baked in risk components into the discount rate. It was not a pure try to come to the net rate.
I don't understand when you say partially baked in risk components.
Okay, well, let me have a go at that then.
Yeah, I think I do agree.
I think there's a market spread that they could have taken out. But the market spread is an amalgam of more than one of the boxes.
Keeping a free lunch bit, yeah.
Well, they're keeping a bit of it, and they had a choice. They could either overshoot by taking everything out or undershoot by taking some things out and not others. And I think what they've tried to do is come up with a methodology to measure a piece that they think they can measure in some sort of reasonable way and accept that it's going to leave something in that, in an ideal world, you might not leave in. And the question is that enough, or would you make them go the full way and take everything out in the knowledge that that's probably going a bit too far? In terms of the actual portfolio, I think you're right there. I think they would argue, though, that there's another mechanism in there that at least partially corrects for that, which is that they would argue that in their regulatory system, and to some extent through the financial reporting, they've got incentives to try and keep the assets reasonably closely matched to the liability characteristics. So it's a kind of reference portfolio. You might argue about how close it up is, but I think their view is that they're sort of close enough that you don't adjust for those differences.
Okay, two more and then we'll close down. John, Tom first and then John.
If I think through, if we start with a top-down approach and try to think about what proposals we saw, obviously, if you start with an asset rate and you're only accounting for the liability, you got to take out of the asset rate things that are only related to the asset that are not in the liability. I think there's two things, default risk and the compensation for uncertainty in the return.
That's right.
So you'd have to deduct those two things.
That's
But in the asset rate, that asset rate assumes liquid assets. And you don't have a liquid liability, so you've got to add back in the liquidity premium. And so top-down or bottom-up, if I analyze the risks that are inherent in the liability that are not in the cash flows and I have to adjust, I think I have to adjust for at least those three. You could also do add credit on the liability side, but we've decided to ignore that. And you could also add uncertainty in the outflows, but we're putting that directly in the risk margin. But there's five things you could think about from the start, two of which we're either ignoring or accounting for, but there's still three adjustments, and you still got the liquidity premium in there. And that's all assuming none of those things were in the cash flows. And we don't know whether they're in the cash flows or not. So that thought process says top-down becomes very complicated relative to bottom-up. And it also tells me, because I can't think what's in the cash flows, that there's going to be some fuzziness in our result of this thought process. And that's why I go back to, even though I understand why the actual rate that you determine by looking at inflows and outflows and pricing the contract's not perfect, I'm not sure we're ever going to get perfection in the exact adjustments. So I don't know that – I think your recommendation is to get rid of the pricing rate. I'm not so sure that it's not going to be good enough compared to all of the sort of scientific guesses where I'm going to make either bottom-up or top-down and then trying to measure all those components. It's going to be difficult.
I would say – I think I speak for Matthias as well. I don't think that our recommendation is to get rid of the pricing rate. I just think that we were not convinced that you could do it.
Yeah,
that's if you can do it and you can capture all those things that you just mentioned, then that's fine.
I guess to add to that, our recommendation, even though the recommendation comes later, will be that we should achieve the objective to measure these cash flows based on their characteristics.
Exactly right.
And the only thing that we do not want people to have is being locked in into one methodology that they don't get their hands around. And therefore, we thought it would give people the opportunity to develop or use methodologies they have in place to approximate what we are trying to achieve with the discount rate on another way. So that is the only move that we are trying to do. We want to have market consistency in the inputs, and that's what's in the recommendation, as you can see later on. We want to have a current measurement. We specifically include that we do not want to have double counting in the rate, but we do not want to tell people there's only the Solvency II method to determine your discount rate. And that is sorry to jump ahead on the conclusion, but that is where we're trying to head here. And people have told us we can't do this. However, we think we can achieve the goal that you have, your objective, on another way. And this is why we think we would not want to restrict people to one methodology.
And I agree with all of what you just said. The only thing I would recommend that we also have to think about helping them think through how you do your paragraph 75 adjustments in the context of what you're doing by at least giving some implementation guidance about what factors to think of when you're going top down. Perhaps I'm right in what I just said, but I think we'd want to have some outreach to check that and on bottom up.
Okay, John?
I've got a mechanical question. Using the bottom up,
when I think of the portfolio, are there periods when I have net positive cash flows coming in versus flows going out?
On the portfolio or on the single contract level?
Portfolio.
Depends on the nature of that insurance company. If it's a startup, maybe, yeah.
Would that then tell me that I need more than just a add back on default and liquidity, the way you have it here?
Not sure. But we're really trying only to.
There's a period where there's a net positive.
Yeah.
then there's no default adjustment going the way you've got it, right?
In the bottom up, I don't have that. If you look at that, if you
for default risk, what does that mean? In the bottom up,
that's top down.
If you would look at that picture, what would be in a risk-free plus liquidity rate would be the bottom. It would include the reward for illiquidity risk, and it would be the liquidity losses on forced sales, which would be included if you think in these categories.
And you'd be adding it, right?
Yeah, I would be adding on. I would not have any defaults in there.
And that's always an add-on.
And again, we are really trying to measure illiquid cash flows, even if it's cash inflows. That really doesn't matter because that is then decreasing the value of these cash flows if I'm increasing the interest rate there.
Okay. I really want to start closing now because we don't have to remind us tomorrow morning what we're doing. If you want to turn to the conclusions. Russ, is there something you need to know? Is it quick?
If Shane's assumption that paragraph 75C2, which is describing qualitatively what are the things that you should consider. 77. And that a bottom-up and a top-down approach should theoretically arrive at a similar rate. And if Tom's assumption that in both cases you have to deal with illiquidity, if that's true, I don't understand how the recommendation is going to help our constituents. They raised 3 points, volatility, day one loss, and this is too hard to do. You're still going to have volatility. If it's the similar rate, you're still going to have day one losses. And if you got to deal with illiquidity in the top down or bottom up, they're still going to have difficulty. So my question is, if those assumptions are correct, how does this help our constituents?
So to go to volatility, start with that first. I think if it's economic volatility, that's what we want to see, or at least that's one of the working assumptions that we have just heard an hour ago. Too hard to do. We were trying to address that by saying we heard different methods out there. We don't want to preclude people from getting there, so.
But both methods have the same thing that's too hard to do.
But I think that it may be easier for some to do a bottom up, while it may be easier for others to do a top down. But we heard consistently, don't prescribe a bottom up because we know that that's hard. So, I don't know. I'm not sure that that's a great answer.
As I understand the thinking that's been going on in the paper, what they're saying is that at this stage we're talking about the objective. We're saying the objective is the risk-free plus liquidity. Another point, part of the paper, which we'll come back to tomorrow morning, is about whether a prescribed rate might work as a practical expedient. And that next piece that we'll consider tomorrow morning might help them. But in terms of the principle is risk-free plus liquidity, and we don't address your 3 points in this, but as we add the next piece, that might help.
Well, and perhaps if we think again of what they're doing in the existing Canadian approach, that they're taking out some deductions, and in a sense what they're doing is they're assuming that whatever's left must be the liquidity adjustment, and they probably haven't spent much time thinking about it in those terms and whether they can rationalise it in those terms. But
I'd add to that, if you remember Peter said before, do you force them to undershoot or overshoot? And I think that probably they're using the spreads as a sort of a proxy for the illiquidity premium, and so it does deal in
that,
part with
that would make it easier, yeah.
It deals with the volatility in part. I think it could
all okay, are we going to vote on this now? Because I've got more things I want to say.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, can you be quick then, Steve, because it's 6:30 now.
My concern is that if we allow the top-down, all you're going to do is to effectively have a quasi-asset rate, because they won't take out enough, and I think the Canadian data that they sent in demonstrates that the rate would vary by how aggressive you were on the asset side. So I have concerns. However, I'm willing to support it as long as we disclose by currency the yield curve. Mm-hmm. Because then I think that will force, that'll provide the discipline within the market to make sure that people don't start changing the rate by composition of the asset portfolio. If we don't disclose that, then I think the only sensible approach is a reference mm-hmm. market rate to provide some discipline.
Okay. Just for
question one, we can't deal with question two just now. And I just want to run through the recommendations. This is paragraph 77. Question A, anyone disagree? Okay. B, which is don't prescribe, and tomorrow we're going to look at the whether we can have some expedient brought in, but at the moment, don't prescribe a rate. Anyone disagree? Okay.
27, 28.
Paragraph
77. Okay, we've done A and B. Have any problems? Those that hadn't got there, Pat?
I'm just concerned in A about the way they stated the objective, because we started out in the exposure draft with a rate that reflected the characteristics of the liability, and now we're just saying the objective is to adjust the future cash flows for the time value of money. So I was wondering what happened to the characteristics of the liability, which was what was driving all these adjustments in and out, or do I just misunderstand what 77A says?
That would be C.
C1.
But that's guidance.
Okay.
Hmm? Okay, but and C is not as authoritative as A.
Can I suggest we carry on with the vote, and we'll just bring some words back tomorrow to confirm that we've understood that correctly.
Thank
just
as a double. Okay, yeah. We'll keep your point on hold, Pat. Is that okay? They're going to bring back. That's Larry's point too. Bring some words back.
Yeah.
Okay. The point taken about the liability, we have to get some words for us how it fits. And the guidance on C1 to 3. Okay.
I,